Okay, lovely saucer here.
Hey, Brian, what are you doing?
Well, Richard, in honor of you remaining on as our co-host, I thought I would set up a proper English tea service.
That is such a stereotype. Not what? All British people like tea.
You're kidding me. I thought that was just something you guys did every day. Is that not correct?
But it's just harkening back to our days of imperialism. It's such a cliche.
Well, it's not like I was going to throw it in the bay. I just thought maybe we could enjoy, you know, a proper dainty, because, you know, you're British and therefore probably very dainty. I thought that was just part of the deal.
Yeah. Oh, dainty. Yeah. Dainty. I'll show you dainty at the end of my boot, sir.
Okay. All right. Maybe I was a little out of bounds, but before I go to all the trouble of throwing this all away, would you like some tea?
Oh, yes. Milk and two sugars, please.
Hello, kings and jacks and those just jacking around. Welcome to another shuffled episode of Digital Noise right here on oneofus.net. This is the Blu-ray DVD review show that is always at full resolution but is never, ever playing with a full deck. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, dealer's choice, and joining me once more is the Ginger Joker himself, Mr. Richard Whittaker from the Austin Chronicle. Hello, sir.
Hey, up.
You're back.
I am.
You survived.
I never left.
You've just been sitting in the office for a week.
It was sad and lonely, but I dealt with it.
We did leave the refrigerator light on, so it wasn't completely dark in here.
And a bowl of water, and the window cracked it a little bit. That's all I need. I'm a man of very simple needs.
That's good. That's good. That's exactly why we brought you on, because there is very little to be gained from being the co-host of this show. So it's good that you're not looking for much. Anywho. Chris is still somewhere in Asia. We hope for the best there.
Well, we hope he's still somewhere in Asia.
We have no way of knowing.
Well, apart from Facebook and Twitter and...
There is literally no way of knowing. There is no communication system whatsoever. And besides, I mean, anything he posts on Facebook could have been edited by the government.
Because desperate lies.
They could have been monitoring all of that. We just don't know.
Are you saying Chris Cox is a false flag operation?
Yes. I've been saying that for years, and no one has been listening, but now... Now they will learn.
The truth is out.
It is not I who am mad. It is the world that is mad. And me as well. I want to remind you guys that Digital Noise, just like all of our content here at One of Us, is available on iTunes. All you got to do is search for One of Us in the podcast section. Also want to remind you that you can become a subscriber of oneofus.net. If you look on the sidebar there in the top right, you'll see a fancy little icon that takes you somewhere where you can give $1 to $25 every single month, or just make a one-time donation. And of course, you can cancel at any time. Anything you can afford, we are very happy to have, because that's partially how we keep doing what we do here.
Do it, people. Do it. You know you want to.
And that is a British person saying that. And if there's any class of people that has been historically very pushy, it's the Brits.
That would be us. That's how we ended up with an empire. We just turned up and went, can we have this?
That's
and
true.
Everybody went... No, we meant, oh, go on.
You still refuse to give up the Falkland Islands, even though you have no use for them whatsoever.
I know, that's hilarious, isn't it?
What are you doing there? I have to know. Well, why do you still have it?
I think it's just to be pissy.
It may be. Just the sore loser type thing?
Oh, no, sore winner.
that's true. I should read.
Do you want it? Do you want it? Oh, no.
No,
sorry.
It's ours. We still own it. Joke's on you. Anywho, I also want to mention, I don't know if everyone knows this, but oneofus.net has its own YouTube channel that you can go and watch things like the internet show, which is also hosted by someone from the UK.
Ooh.
Chris Harrison, who we've taken to calling Scottish Intern, runs a weekly movie and pop culture news show called Internet Show, where he does a lot of crazy things, a lot of sketches, a lot of cool editing and just general babblings about the world at large, or the rather small world that is our pop culture world. But I highly recommend you check it out. That's also where we post the videos for things like Minecraft and any one-offs we may do. Really cool stuff there. Definitely go check it out. Subscribe, tell your friends, all that good stuff. And hey, we've reached a milestone.
A milestone?
Richard, I'm so excited. This is our 20th episode of Digital Noise. Yes.
What?
We are still a website. Well, we're still a podcast on a website that is still a website. I am completely blown away by all of that. And that's largely due to you guys continuing to support us and listen and buy stuff off our Amazon links. We really do appreciate that. And hopefully, with your help, 20 will seem like a really silly thing to celebrate when we are crossing into the 500s and 600s. Or, you know, if we're still alive, we may be dead. It's very likely.
I, for one, look forward to the day where your talkback boards are, and forums are just people complaining about how you were so much better in the early days.
Oh, my gosh. We are going to have Digital Noise hipsters. Oh, that would be so great. I would love to have hipsters. Anyway, pomp, circumstance, and agape shock faces all around. Before we get too more lost in media detritus, let's get incommunicado with you guys, which actually means we're not communicating, but I'm repurposing the phrase. That's right, I'm taking it back. We're going to crack open
the letter box.
You've got mail.
That's our word.
The letter box. Yes, indeed. And our first question comes from Sam Gelber, who says, "Hello, DigiNoisers and British guy." Hey!
He
made it
Hello.
Into the question. He says he's excited about the Vincent Price collection and wonders what other actor we would like to see a release. We would like to see them release a set for like that. Is there a particular actor that jumps to mind immediately for you?
I was thinking about this, and I ran through some options. I thought Peter Lorre, because there's a lot of kind of obscure Peter Lorre that people don't know.
Sure.
They just know him as like the kind of sleazy small guy.
Whereas something like Mad Love goes completely unnoticed, unfortunately.
Yeah, and none of people know M, even.
That's true. That's very true.
And then I was thinking Alec Guinness, because I think there's so many people over here don't know his Ealing comedies. And things like Kind Hearts and Coronets, which is hilarious and, frankly, the main gimmick for Dr. Strangelove was kind of ripped off from it, because he plays every part in this entire family. And having the one actor keep coming back with is very much, you know, ripped off from that.
Sure.
But I have to go with Peter Cushing.
Oh, of course.
Because I think you could do something very similar to what Shout did for the Vincent Price set and pick an era of his work and just go... Yeah, you don't even have to look at like the really famous Hammer stuff, but his work in the 60s and 70s, it's, you know, he was just, when he was a bad guy, he was really evil. When he was a good guy, you got the feeling he was somebody who understood that there was evil in the world. I mean, he just had this wonderful grasp of what malice and menace was, which was completely contrary to who he was. Apparently, he was just a complete cuddle bunny. It was just the world's nicest human being, you know. But yeah, I was looking through his filmography from like the 60s and 70s, and there's all this amazing stuff. Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell, which is astonishing. Madhouse, Shatter, Satanic Rites of Dracula. You know, you could, it'd be like the Vincent Price set, that you could go through and go, this is all amazing stuff, and I could do it twice over. So I've got to go with Peter Cushing.
That's actually a really great choice, and I liked what you said about, I mean, and it's not just about an era defining, you know, a part of an actor's life, but it can be the, you know, the reverse of that as well, where there may be one actor who in and of himself embodies an era of cinema. And that's why my pick would actually be Warren Oates.
Ooh.
I feel like Warren Oates is a very underrated, underappreciated actor who really defined the early 70s and much of the 1970s in terms of what it meant to just kind of be out there on the fringe of filmmaking. I mean, it's a guy like, if you've never seen Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, holy God, definitely my favorite Sam Peckinpah film, and just so typifies what was great about Warren Oates in the first place. He's also really great in actually two films by, I'm going to blank on the name, Tulane Blacktop, Monty Hellman, Tulane Blacktop and The Shootist. Just absolutely phenomenal filmmaking. And Race with the Devil. If you haven't seen Race with the Devil, it's a film about a two couples who go on this road trip in their RV, and they happen to stumble across a satanic rite in progress, and the rest of the film is them being chased by this cult. And I mean, you talk about a horror movie on wheels at high speed, it is fantastic. Highly recommend it. He's great as John Dillinger. He's in a film called Kid Blue that's very good. I mean, again, this is an actor who, is the 70s. I mean, he's even in True Grit, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
This is somebody that if you're not familiar with his work, you really need to go back and just go to the great films of the 70s, because odds are you will land on a Warren Oates project. He's just that good. And I would love to see, like, even if it was like, because The Wild Bunches, he's also great in that. I mean, but even if you just made the cutoff from like 70 to 79, you'd still have at least 8 films in that set that were outstanding.
And they Shout Factory just re-released Race of the Devil in a double pack, which makes it really a Peter Fonda pack, because it's
Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, no, there's, you know, put a another one. I'm with you. I have a funny feeling Warren Oates' daughter lives in Austin. I could be completely wrong with
that. We must have her on the show at some point. If that is the case, I need to make phone calls and make that happen.
I'm moderately sure she's local.
Good. I'm tracking that information down. Thank you. Thank you for that, Richard. This is why it helps to have an actual newspaper man on the show. We also have a question from Michael Vander. This is like my trademark, is every episode I screw up at least one name. I'm going to say it's Vanderpool, who asks, or he says, early this summer he saw a community theater that reopened and showed old movies, and then of course the big chain theaters have started doing that as well. He asks, what are 3 movies you missed out on the big screen that you would love to see? His are Jaws, Blade Runner, and A Clockwork Orange. How about you, Richard?
I'm old enough that I've seen most most of them, not all. I think my first one would have to be the Disney Pinocchio.
Okay.
Because I've seen that on TV and on VHS.
Hooray!
On the V-man H&S thing. So
was that
many...
Jerry Lewis telling us what VHS stood for?
Hey, V-man lady!
H&S
and... You know, the scenes in the circus and with the whale just cry out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this needs to be seen in 35mm, just, you know, or 70. Somebody can hunt down a print, I will kill you for it. I think that's probably going to be, that's my top one. Two more. So it's one of the problems of being in Austin. You get to see so much stuff.
That's very true.
It turns up.
That's what makes this question difficult to answer, is because even the things that were released either before I was born or before I was really into cinema, have been shown at the Alamo Drafthouse, usually in 35, sometimes even in 70mm.
Yeah.
But there are definitely, like, I'll go ahead and throw one out that I really want to see on the big screen, and that's Casablanca. I've still yet to see, and I'm even willing to bet there has been a screening of Casablanca.
It's like every summer at the Paramount they show Casablanca.
You
just need to go to the Paramount summer season.
I just have to sit through being at the Paramount, which is a theater that I love what they do. I appreciate everything they do at the Paramount, but that theater, in terms of logistics of sitting and watching a movie, is one of the worst. Just really tiny aisles, and you feel like your knees are in your tits. And it's just, it's not a very pleasant experience. And then the thing you have to understand is the theater wasn't built as a movie theater. It was built as a performance theater. So you still have these really archaic, sort of ornate balconies that block a sizable portion of the main floor from the screen. And so you have to be sitting in the exact right place, and then you're cramped up in these little tiny aisles. And it's not my favorite place to see a movie. That being said, their summer series is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I give them all the credit in the world for that.
I think another film I'd really like to see, not because I actually like it as a film, but I think it'd be special to see it in 35mm, would be Barry Lyndon, which is glacially slow. Like I find it incredibly tedious. But just to actually see a film which was shot in 35mm using just the natural or ambient light, that's something I think that just as a piece of cinema, just pure cinema, a spectacle, I would really, really like to see. And my third one, because I've never seen it on the big screen, and it's like Casablanca. It's like, how the fuck have I kept missing it? Psycho. Never seen Psycho on the big screen.
Yeah.
I've seen it dozens of times, but I've never seen it on the big screen. I have seen the remake on the big screen, which is not as terrible as everybody liked to make out at the time. It is kind of pointless, but the pointlessness of it was the point of it. Meta. But yeah, I think it's going to be those 3. 2 of them because I really like them as films, and just want to see them in their native environment, and 1 just out of kind of morbid cineast fascination.
Gotcha. My other 2, one of them would have to be The Long Goodbye. which is unfortunately a film that I only discovered at the beginning of last year, and I have just fallen head over heels in love with and watch every chance that I get. And to see that on the big screen with just sort of the melodic cool that underscores that entire movie and just the effortless charm of Elliot Gould, I definitely want to see that. I would feel the problem with that is that I would want to have a cigarette. I don't even smoke, but something about that movie would just make me want to have a cigarette as I watched it. And I think the other playing off the Hitchcock thing would be Rope, which my favorite Hitchcock movie, because I would love to see a film that only has three broken cuts throughout the entire run of the film on the big screen and see if, you know, in that format, in a wider presentation, if it's easier or harder to point out the moments where that cut happens. So definitely something I would want to see on the big screen. And
I would add in anything I was subjected to on VHS pan and scan in the 80s. Just on principle, just like, what did I miss?
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
There's a generation of film fans who grew up with the weirdest panning and tracking shots.
Yeah.
Just because they saw all this stuff and it was like, you know, it was actually a locked shot, but it's just bouncing between two characters on the opposite end. So we all end up with cinematic whiplash.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And that's not what the cinematographer intended, in case you guys didn't know that. Thank you, Sam and Michael, for your questions, guys. Please continue to submit those whenever we prompt for them. We really do appreciate it. And now it's time to poxy glue the eyelids open and dive into the reviews. I want to remind you that everything we talk about will have a link right here on this post that takes you directly to Amazon. You can either buy that particular title or anything that you buy on Amazon, as long as you get there via our links, actually benefits the site. So we really do appreciate you guys. Keep doing that, especially as the holidays are coming up. You're doing a lot of shopping on Amazon. Anytime you think, oh, I need to get a gift for so-and-so, please come here first. Easiest thing in the world to do is just look on the sidebar for the pick of the week. Click on that. It'll take you to Amazon. You can search for whatever item you want to buy. As long as you get there via our link, we get a cut of that purchase. So again, thank you very much. And we're going to start with what is undoubtedly the biggest release of the week, which is Snuff. No, I'm just kidding. It's Man of Steel, which is about this super guy I've been hearing so much about.
Allegedly.
With the tights and the cape.
No tights!
And the jingoism. Man of Steel is Zack Snyder's Superman movie. Thank God they rebooted it, because it had been almost 8 years, maybe, since the last reboot.
When was...
I want to say it was like 2006.
If that feels right, but it feels like it's probably like it's never gone away.
No, it hasn't. And that was one of the weird things about, I mean, from day one, about hearing that they were going to completely reboot the characters, like, two things. One, we just had a reboot. And two, who by this point doesn't know Superman's origin story?
Well, the thing with Superman Returns was that it was such a weird film for me because it wasn't a reboot. It was a weird, slavish sequel to the 70s version.
That's true.
So, and it was like, the haircuts are weird. The behavior just doesn't feel right anymore. And it also means you ignore, you know, Superman 3, 4, and 5, which, you know, fair enough. I'm not going to blame you for.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was just weird. And I could see why they'd come out of that and go, well, that was a horrible misfire. Let's give it another shot.
Mm.
Who's free to direct this?
Yeah, Zack Snyder.
Yeah.
Strange choice. Although I will say this for Zack Snyder. I've heard all of the vitriol that a lot of people spit towards Zack Snyder about him not being a very good filmmaker. But up until Sucker Punch, I couldn't even recall a Zack Snyder film that I didn't at least enjoy on some level.
Yeah.
The Dawn of the Dead remake was great. I actually like Watchmen as a movie, but not as an adaptation. And, you know, even that Owl movie was actually pretty good. So I wasn't against Zack Snyder taking on Superman. What I fear has happened as a result of Man of Steel is that he's been thrust into the sort of the Neo Christopher Nolan role, where it's like, okay, now you have to save the studio. Now, we're literally putting an S on your chest and saying, do everything and get us back to prominence. But that is neither here nor there. We're talking about Man of Steel itself. Now, you're right. Superman Returns wasn't soup to nuts a reboot, but it was definitely a new incarnation of the character, and it definitely had a completely different spirit and vibe from all of the Christopher Reeve versions. And it just felt weird to just negate all it, just to throw it away.
Yeah.
Just like to be like so soon afterwards, just be like, no, forget all of that. It's just, it's nothing now. And so we've got Man of Steel, which starts out telling the story a little more in depth about what happened on Krypton. All we really knew cinematically was that there were a lot of hula hoops and giant old faces and glimmering tinfoil suits and pompadours, and then it exploded. I mean, that's pretty much all we had to go on. So this does go a little more in detail, not only about... And I like the idea better, by the way, that Krypton's core is the issue and not that the sun is about to explode.
Yeah.
Because you'd think that it'd be hard to be contrarian or pessimistic about someone going... guys, you know that we're going to melt, because you should have by that point. If the sun is close enough to be days away from obliterating the planet, you think someone would go, you know, it's getting really hot. You know, the seas look like they're a little boily today. Yeah. So I like the idea that it's the core that's erupting. But they also go into this coup between General Zod and the leaders of the planet. And what's really interesting about that story to me is that you realize that Zod and Jor-El are kind of, they're coming at it from two completely different ways, but they're kind of on the same side. They both have a problem with the leadership of Krypton ignoring what's happening to the planet, but Jor-El is trying to, you know, inspire them to action with his words and with discourse, and Zod's just like, oh, well, let's stage a bloody coup and I'll just take over the planet and fix this.
And as Homer Simpson said, when will people learn democracy doesn't work?
And the only reason I'm going so in-depth into this is because it brings me to the thing I really did like, I did very much like about Man of Steel, which was Michael Shannon as Zod. I really thought that he brought an intensity, but also a humanity to Zod that we hadn't really seen in the previous version. Like, all deference to Terrence Stamp. Terrence Stamp's Zod was kind of a silly queen. I mean, I don't really know how else to describe it. Just very, very prim, very kneel before me, and oh, look what I did with my eyes. I seem to have burned this snake. Just like, okay, well, I guess that's the Zod we got.
And he was wearing his pajamas. Which
doesn't change a heck of a lot in this movie now that I think
it's
got
to be said, the old school... Krypton, you kind of go, well, you deserve to blow up. You guys are kind of rubbish.
You're a planet based around the idea of comfort at the Playboy Mansion.
You're all wearing your dressing gowns. You know, you're going to get eradicated at some point.
Yeah. And the other thing about Man of Steel that I really did like was Kevin Costner as Jonathan Kent. I thought gave us a character that we could so rally behind, and a character who is conflicted in such a way that he is pressing the idea that Clark needs to protect his secret at all costs, and what he's willing to do personally to protect Clark's secret. And the scene that you've probably seen in the trailer, even if you haven't seen in the movie, where he reveals to Clark, you know, where he came from, and Clark says, can I just go back to being your son? And he has this really heartfelt, really sincere moment where he just says, you know, you are my son. And it's something that I'm sure all fathers or anyone who's close to their father could appreciate. And I think what he did with that character was great. I don't know, Richard, what about... Okay, in terms of the positives, what you liked about Man of Steel, what do you got for me?
Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
Who just should just be given every script he wants and just be allowed to do stuff with it.
I agree.
Because he is phenomenal in this. I kind of disagree with you on him being humanized, because you get to the end of it and you're kind of like, well, he has a point. And I'm like, no, he's still the bad guy.
Well,
and there's also this big subplot, which where it kind of got, it tried to build up a little bit too much mythology about the whole idea that Krypton had outlawed natural birth and there's population control and all the babies are born in the pods from the Matrix movies.
It gets a little Aldous Huxley, because it is like you're born for specific tasks.
Yeah.
You're engineered to serve one of four functions in society. So yeah, I agree with you that storyline got a little, but where I think the humanity exists is if you look at the Terrence Stamp Zod, it's like all he really wants is power.
Yeah.
But the Michael Shannon Zod wants to save an entire species.
Well,
and the way he goes about it, unfortunately, puts us as humanity in a precarious position. But his motives, in his eyes, are still very, they're very altruistic.
Well, hang on, don't get it confused. Don't think that I think the original Superman films are that great. Because I don't. I understand that people love them. I don't, and it goes back to, I have a basic problem with Superman that I think it was Alan Moore early on said, you know, what is there interesting to say about him? It's the Further Adventures of God. the one thing I did like about this is they did scrape some of the Big Blue Schoolboy off him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not perfect, which has annoyed a lot of people because they go, well, Superman's kind of perfect. I'm like, well, there's nothing to say then. You've got to give him some dramatic tension.
Yeah.
I was not a fan of Kevin Costner's character in this because some of the stuff he says, I'm like, no, that's just kind of asshole-y. Oh, you should. Everybody was going to drown. Like, no. Like, of course you'd save them. You'd find a way to save them.
I think you just haven't gotten over his role in The Bodyguard. You wanted him to protect everyone in the world. Did we just break the microphone? No, they're still working. These are good mics.
Shattered the window. And he has a moment that, let's just, for our sakes, we're not spoiling it for anybody, but the dog rescue moment, which is the stupidest thing I've seen anybody
love
do.
It.
I hated that moment.
Love it, love
he
it,
just
love
stood
it.
There going, and he's like, run away. His hair wasn't even moving, and he's supposed to be next to a tornado.
Okay.
That was stupid.
That's the part that's stupid, then I'll agree with that, but I love the fact that he went back for the dog. That makes me so happy on so many different levels.
But he could still run.
No, like, you're right.
There's so many things about
that. He gets to a Wile E. Coyote point where he just holds up a little sign. It's like, yipe. It's like, dude, just if you have time to make the sign and hold it up to have that ironic moment, you have time to run away.
Yeah.
No, I'll give you that. And one of the things that really bothered me about, and I know this is sort of the chestnut with this film, is it's not so much that a majority of Metropolis is obliterated by the end of this movie. What bothers me about that is there's nothing that happens prior to that that makes me feel like we are watching a hero's journey. It feels to me like what we're watching is an alien with daddy issues trying to work them
two
out.
Two daddy issues.
Two daddy issues. Working them out at the expense of the people on his new home planet. It's not, well, Zod destroyed. Look at, you know, all the people that would have died. It's like, yeah, tragedy happens. Tragedy happens in superhero stories. I get that. But they didn't do anything up to that point, in my opinion, to make Superman feel like a hero. He just felt either, like, you know, at his most empathetic, he was completely lost. And at his strongest, he was, you know, leveling downtown, if there is such a thing, downtown Smallville. Or he's just, when he finally realizes that four people in a bus station might die,
yeah,
is when he makes the decision, oh, if I just... Okay, well, I won't spoil anything. But basically, even though he's let, you know, throughout this whole combat with Zod, because of his scruples, has let an entire city essentially be annihilated. But wait, these four innocent people might die? I guess I better change fundamentally the way I think about this.
Here's my theory.
Mm.
I think that is all set up for Superman versus Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Because now what you have at the end of that is Superman kind of becoming vaguely heroic, and, you know, going, oh, I'm going to defend truth, justice, and the American way, although he doesn't say those words explicitly. I'm just waiting for them. If I was Bruce Wayne in down or really up the coast in Gotham, I'd be going, what the hell?
What did you do?
Okay, I am the world's greatest detective and extremely smart. How do I hunt this guy down and stop him?
Yeah.
Because he will do this again because he doesn't understand.
Well, in Superman's defense, it was Batman who let Gotham become no man's land, literally, if you read comics, in The Dark Knight Rises. And, you know, so, I mean, I think it's funny. I think they could do more of a buddy cop thing where it's like, how did you fuck up your town? Now, how did you fuck up your town?
We
have stories to share. yeah, so I mean, I think it has problems. I definitely understand a lot of the issues that people have, and I definitely understand there is this sort of overbearing religious, I don't know if you could call it subtext. It's like super text.
Oh no, when he flies up in above the earth and strikes the crucifix pose, and I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, is this a metaphor?
Yeah, he basically goes to confession at one point during the film, and it's like, what is going on, Snyder?
And that's the funny thing. You know, a character who all the subtext in history says is pretty explicitly Jewish. and then Zack Snyder goes, nope, bang, 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 bang. The thing I did like about it It was kind of a good and a bad. Mm-hmm. Like you, Zack Snyder can do kind of tiny grim zombie movies until the end of time. I would be quite happy for him to go back and do that kind of thing again. I love 300. I know I shouldn't.
Oh, 300, yeah.
300, I think, is just a great, ridiculous piece of cinema. Sure. I watched it again recently, and I'm like, nothing about this is defensible at any level, and I don't care. I love this film. It's stupid and big and wonderful and visually unique, and so many people have now ripped it off. Sucker Punch. God damn it.
Nobody knows what happened
there. How do you take all those premises, all those concepts of like mech suits and dragons and then just wreck it? Well, just wreck it so badly with by the way, all the characters are being raped regularly. We're like, oh God, this is just the squeeziest.
When you know going in that the whole movie is just Rape Escape, and no, I'm not talking about the one with Steve McQueen, but when it's all just Rape Escape fantasy, it's like, you should turn down the movie immediately. When you realize that that's what's going on, you go, oh, you know what? There's not a good way to do this that isn't going to creep everybody out. So probably the worst thing I could do would be to hire stunningly beautiful actresses and then dress them like children and remind you over and over again, even as they're being highly sexualized, that they are still playing children. That probably will edge out all of the creepiness you feel about the fact that this is Rape Escape.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of half Lord of the Rings, half Moulin Rouge, and then you realize, oh no, I'm watching the really nasty sequences in Straw Dogs.
Yeah.
This film is, I have no defense for that movie. True. And I should be able to, and like, no. But he keeps all the kind of overblown and crazy, there's some flashes of it. Like, there's a wonderful moment where there's these big giant robot tentacles, which are formed out of basically the Kryptonian scrap metal, which is semi-sentient and crops up all over the place. And that's the design of Kryptonian technology is brilliant.
True.
Like, you really get a feeling for there is an underlying tech that has governed how this entire planet has evolved. They carry that through beautifully. And I thought that was, from a design point of view, I think this is spectacular.
Agreed.
From a narrative point of view, it's so all over the place. And I was even unclear in places like when the Kryptonians get to Earth. It's like when they have powers and when they don't. And they try
when
to create...
can breathe, when they can't breathe.
Yeah, they try to create a bigger logical for why Superman has these incredible powers, and it seems to be that Krypton has higher gravity, and I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. It actually made less sense than it's the sun.
Yeah, it's
which
just
is, which
the
is
sun.
Stupid, but you're like, okay, I believe you.
It's Deus Ex Sun.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's big and it's very well put together. And Michael Shannon does get to go around and go, grrr, so spectacular, just wonderfully accurate.
I will find him.
Yeah, his battle armor is spectacular. I have no idea why he suddenly tears that off at the end, apart from maybe they just got tired of rendering it.
I think it was just hot, man. That looked like it was 100 degrees in that fucking suit.
But it's like suddenly he just goes, I'm in my underwear, which he was. If you realize... And the final battle sequence is Michael Shannon in his underwear.
Yeah.
It suddenly gets a bit weirder.
A little weirder, but not a heck of a lot weirder considering what
not
we're
Sucker Punch
at.
Weird, but you know.
True. Yeah, I mean, overall, I think what the problem is that you have to work, for me anyway, you have to work very hard to create a Superman story that I'm going to care about, because Superman, for me, was always that kid who refused to play the same game that you were. The kid who was always like, you would be playing, some sort of imaginative game, and you'd come up to him and you'd say, haha, I dropped a rock on you. And he's like, no, I'm super strong. You're like, okay, well, I burned you with fire. No, I'm fireproof. He just kept changing the game and doling out this unstoppable, endless plethora of powers to the point that you're just not having fun anymore.
Yeah.
And that was always Superman for me, was that character. So I feel like in order for me to get past that, the movie has to either present something entirely novel or something really spectacularly entertaining or something that is just visually arresting. And I feel like there are flashes of each of those things in Man of Steel, but not enough for me to get really excited about it, which is why I had such a middling opinion of the film in the first place and why I found the overall experience of watching it just sort of super meh.
It does have rival Robin Hoods as his rival dads, which is kind of awesome.
That's very true, and none can argue with that.
As far as this Blu-ray, I have some gripes. And yes, Warner Brothers, you are going to get an earful. First of all, so what we're talking about here is the Blu-ray, DVD, and digital HD ultraviolet, which I just have never used ultraviolet in my life. But it keeps being a thing, I guess. Okay, first complaint. So on the little, what do they call this? The sleeve, the slide cover, they have a name for it, the slip cover. You have where you've upraised an image. So the image on the cover is the S, and then Superman flying straight up through the S with the jet stream behind him. And they've upraised the lettering of Man of Steel, and they've also upraised Superman and his jet stream, which is cool, except that it's right down the middle. And with it raised like that, you know what it looks like? It looks like somebody folded your damn slipcover in half.
It does!
It looks like a big fucking crease, like an ugly, you've had this case for too long type crease on a brand new release. So, strike one. Strike two being that this is a three-disc edition. And, Richard, how many slots do you notice there for discs?
I see two.
There are two for three discs, which means that they have put the actual Blu-ray on top of... Oh, see, I just dropped it, because that's not how they should be packaged. It's on top of the special features disc, and then you have the DVD on the left side. There are two slots for three discs, which means there are two of them doubling up, which this is just a standard Blu-ray case. This is not anything that's built for that. So that is not the ideal way to store these, because that's how you're going to get a lot of scratches, and you're going to drop the damn disc like I just did, because... Okay, I'm sorry, Warner Brothers. How much money did you make on this? Don't be cheap. Put a third damn... flip sleeve in there so you can put the third disc on it.
And I've got to say, this goes to one of my constant gripes, the DVD, Blu-ray, ultraviolet combo pack. Mm-hmm. It's like, there must... Like, how many people really go, oh, yes, I must have all three discs?
Yeah.
Wreck-It Ralph was a four-disc set, and each of them was just different versions of the film.
Yeah.
I'm like, no!
Yeah,
give me a download code. You don't have to put a third disc in there. If I've got a Blu-ray player, I'll watch the Blu-ray. Why do I need a DVD as well? I don't understand why we are getting these huge wasteful packs.
Mm-hmm.
Are they increasing the sales in a way that we're not comprehending? It just really bugs me, because I've got wasted plastic in my house that I'm not watching.
Well, they have top men looking into that. Top.
Who?
Top. Men. Mm. Yeah, and as far as special features go, this has a lot, but I mean, they're all kind of in the realm of EPK. I mean, anything that you saw, I mean, and Man of Steel wasn't a small release.
Nope.
So leading up to the film, you probably have seen every single one of these featurettes featured on some movie website. They also include the 75th anniversary short film that kind of takes you through the history of Superman, which famously does not include Brandon Routh at all. Nor does it include Dean Cain. So those two guys are just kind of, out in the cold. They've decided to omit them from the legacy of Superman, which, don't get me wrong, I understand Lois and Clark was a silly show. I get it. But that doesn't mean the guy hasn't played Superman. And when you're literally going through, and I don't know why I said literally like Rob Lowe, but when you're literally going through and talking about the legacy of the act, it's not just the character. They have rendered in animation the different actors that have played him. So to just wholesale leave out two of the... There's only been, let's see, we've got George Reeve, we've got Christopher Reeve, we've got Brandon Routh, we've got Dean Cain, and we've got now Henry Cavill with the animated Superman thrown in there, and then an earlier Superman cartoon. So, I mean, you're talking about only a handful of people in the first place, so to leave two of them out is not a small omission.
And particularly Dean Cain, because he probably played Superman for more time on screen than anyone else. So to cut him out is actually horribly offensive.
Oh, yeah, Tom Welling's in there from Smallville.
What?
But not Dean Cain, which I find very strange.
Yeah. Welling may be the only person who comes close on, actual amount of time on screen.
Yeah.
Either in the cape or in the glasses. That's just wrong. Morally wrong.
But anyway, Man of Steel, definitely, if you are a superhero completionist, this is one of the tentpole movies. This once again proves that it was going to take a long time before Warner Brothers did anything other than Superman or Batman. And next up on their slate, Superman versus Batman. So there is that. Moving on from there, we're going to talk about the latest Scream Factory release, which is John Carpenter's Body Bags.
Ooh.
Now, this is one of the very few John Carpenter projects that I have still not seen.
Really?
Richard, I'm going to let you take the helm on this one. So what is Body Bags all about?
Well, one of the great things about this disc is it has a full explanation of the myth behind Body Bags. It was basically Showtime went, we really want our own Tales from the Crypt.
Ah, okay.
And they went to John Carpenter and went, hey, do you want to do a half-hour anthology, horror anthology? He went, great, I've got this idea. It's, instead of in a crypt, we'll set it in a mortuary. And, you know, my character is going...
Differenter.
Yeah, my character is going to be, you know... I'm going to, you know, open up body bags because body bags are that's where they put the really nasty accidents. And we're going to tell the story behind that.
Right.
And it's going to be great and wonderful. And they went, fantastic. Shoot three. It'll be great. So he shot three. He did two of them. Toby Hooper did one. And then they went, hey, we know that you filled this with famous people who are easy to get because you're shooting this in L.A. And like you could go next door where Tom Arnold was shooting Roseanne and have him come over and do a like 2 second cameo, and Greg Nicotero can turn up and do stuff. It's wonderful. We want to move it to Toronto. And he went, well, we can't do it in Toronto because the whole thing is that it's really easy to get people for a day or two to come in and shoot this. And they went, nope, Toronto. And he went, well, I'm not doing it. Bye.
Wow.
Bye. And walked and went off and I think the next project he did might have been Prince of Darkness. I'm trying to remember the running order in his career. But, you know, it could have been so great. The three stories that are on this, they show some promise. They're not amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They do have weirdly good leads. Mark Hamill is the Toby Hooper one as a a baseball player who is driven psychotic by having his an eye transplant. the Korean film The Eye, which was remade in the States.
I think Jessica Alba was in the
remake. Yeah. The Eye just completely rips this off. It is
really?
Absolutely the plot.
Huh.
Like he receives the eye of a serial killer and keeps seeing all the corpses and then tries to kill his wife.
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Hamill, it was, you know, post Star Wars, he'd got a little bit podgy, but you are starting to see the Mark Hamill who becomes one of the most in-demand voiceover actors.
Nice.
He does a fantastic Southern accent that comes out of absolutely nowhere.
Really?
Yeah. Unfortunately, he's married to Twiggy, the model turned actress, who is god awful in that. Talking about great character actor Stacy Keach turns up in one of the installments. He is just so good in it as this guy who's going bald and takes on this very odd cutting edge hair restoration treatment. And he wanders around with this series of increasingly wonderful and ridiculous wigs. I won't spoil it, but it's not hair. And the animation work on what it actually is, the stop motion work, is fantastic. It's really, for a zero budget TV show where they were just calling in favors, it really looks great.
Hmm.
And the first one is a very generic woman trapped in a gas station overnight with a killer trying to get to her. It's not, for the pilot, what was clearly the pilot, it's very nothing. And you would have thought John Carpenter would have done more with it. It's there. This is a real oddity. It's a curio.
Yeah.
Not least because it was never theatrically released in the States. I think it was internationally.
Hmm. So had they intended this to be, they intended it to be a show.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this was basically going to be a long pilot and it never became an entire series.
Interesting.
So it's, you know, and they go on, there's a lot of discussion about it in the, one of the extras, and it's pretty interesting stuff. It is a curiosity.
Yeah.
It's not John Carpenter at his best. It's him having fun with some friends. Half the pleasure of it is going, oh, I recognize him, or I recognize her. And there are so many people in Blink and you'll miss them cameos, and some of them you really got to know your horror background really well, like Greg Nicotero in a terrible wig. It's like, you know, some people are going, who's Greg Nicotero? He's like, well, he's the guy that made The Walking Dead look awesome.
Yeah.
And all these people, you just go, oh, it's him. Oh, there they're gone. They're just in for microseconds. And that was what was going to be the fun thing about the series. It just never came to fruition. It's, you know, if you're a John Carpenter completist,
yeah, that's what it sounds like.
This is unmissable. If you like some interesting background noise, it's definitely a renter. If you're if you're serious about horror, you know, it's worth seeing. Should you, if you've got a strict one in one out policy on your DVD collection at home, is this worth chucking out your copy of Kurosawa's Run? No. But it's pretty entertaining, and it is one of those things that I think so many people have heard about but never seen. That it's worth watching.
Well, I think too, it'd make a nice gift for somebody that has, you know, is a big Carpenter fan and thinks that they've seen everything. It's the one thing that they probably haven't laid eyes on, because before Scream Factory put out this release, really was not widely available anywhere.
I don't know whether it had ever had a DVD release.
So
I think it had a VHS release, but I don't think it's, you know, it's quasi mystical.
We're talking about a TV show, you know, from the late 80s, early 90s era. What kind of picture quality did you?
Really good.
I should have expected it's, something from Scream Factory.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's Scream Factory who, you know, I don't know what pact they struck with the devil, but yeah, it looks fantastic. I don't know, they must have got hold of the original tapes. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I really do think that by the time the Scream Factory run is over, they will have released all of the good Carpenter films.
Yeah.
I mean, they've already given us Halloween. They've already given us Prince of Darkness. They've already given us coming up is Assault on Precinct 13.
Yeah.
So I think by the end of the run, they're just going to have released all the good Carpenter movies. No, The Fog as well.
No, Halloween wasn't them.
They did release one.
Did they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, because I got the 35th anniversary one, which was Warner's.
You know what? You're right. They Scream Factory put out 2 and 3.
Yeah,
you're right. You're absolutely right. Because initially
it's
it was
a rarity, but
initially it was Anchor Bay, and then recently it was another release by I believe it was Warner Brothers in the like ultra thin 35th anniversary edition. Yep, that's absolutely right. So Body Bags, definitely something you want to pick up if you are a huge fan of John Carpenter and who isn't?
Yeah.
And hunger for something of his that you haven't seen before. And big props to Scream Factory, because not only does it have the great picture quality that Richard was mentioning, it also has a commentary, a behind-the-scenes featurette, and a trailer of something that is, again, just a real oddity, something that didn't really exist. It was sort of a failed experiment, and yet they have press materials to share with you. So good on you, Scream Factory. Moving on from there, we're going to talk about another film sort of lost to obscurity for a long time, and that is Ida Lupino's The Hitchhiker. Now, this is a recent release, actually not terribly recent. It's one from a couple weeks ago that I managed to miss, unfortunately. But it's a Library of Congress release, which means that it is one of the preserved films from the National Archives. Now, The Hitchhiker is a pretty... It's a pretty familiar story. It's really a cautionary tale based on the urban legend of why you don't pick up hitchhikers. It's about a serial murderer who goes around. I mean, you know, when we say serial killer these days, we have a definite image, you know, something very dark and, you know, Hannibal Lecter and just dripping with malice. But this guy's really more of a thug. He's just a thug who doesn't care who he kills to get from point A to point B and outrun Johnny Law. So these two guys who are kind of on their way to a fun-filled weekend in Mexico pick up this hitchhiker who happens to be this marauding killer, and he forces them to kind of take him places, and, you know, they're trying not to get killed as they also try to alert people to their situation, and it's a very standard story, but I was very interested in it because one of my favorite films of the 80s, I would say favorite horror film, but it's actually just one of my favorite films of the decade, is The Hitcher by Eric Red. And that stars Rutger Hauer as sort of a similar type character, except that he is more of a complete force of apocalyptic nature. He's not just a thug with a gun. I mean, he is something... There's something otherworldly about his evil. The Hitchhiker is not just tame because of the fact that it was made in the 50s. It's tame because it really is sort of meant to be this cautionary tale for everyone to watch. And like, this is, I mean, they come out with the beginning and have almost like a PSA type font and narration where it's like, this is why you don't pick up hitchhikers. And what I did find interesting about the film is there are particular shots that are just really very, just beautiful. And the way that they're done kind of defies the fact that this feels either like a PSA or like a drive-in film. And doesn't really feel like a piece of art until you get to these shots, like when they first pick him up and they just expertly keep him in shadow. Even as he leans forward into the light, he's only half lit. And it gives me reminds me a lot of the way that Robert Mitchum is shot in Cape Fear. So I really did like that about it. And I like the fact that they made the hitchhiker guy, even though he's just kind of a brash thug, they also gave him this really distinctive look where one of his eyelids is paralyzed, so he can't close that eye all the way. So that's always just something that's kind of watching the two guys even as he's sleeping. But it's a very basic plot. I mean, they have to go here, then they have to go here, and he's trying to get here, and they stop at a store, somebody recognizes them, we gotta go. There's not a lot of twists and turns. It's more of following a very specific pattern. Not a great film, but something that I think stands out as far as being something of that era that walks that line between pure drive-in, you know, filler and something that was meant to be more of a PSA and somewhere in the middle managing to find a way to be art. Now, unfortunately, as much as I love Kino, they obviously did not have a lot of money or a great print to work with.
Or enough people who cared.
Or enough people who cared about the hitchhiker, because this is a rough-looking transfer. And when I say rough, I mean it is raining noise. There is so much. There are so many artifacts on the film, so many sort of sequential octagons of digital noise, that it just looks like there's sheets of distortion raining down all the time. And there were a couple moments where I could have sworn that I could hear the noise on the film, like the actual, as it was going through the projector or whatever, you know, system that they were using to transfer it to Blu-ray, you could almost hear it going through. That's how many miles of bad road this print looked like it had been dragged through.
Why even put it on blue?
That's a good question. I really don't have an answer for you. That's as much as I have sympathy for the plight of trying to take this movie that probably has one existing print that has been kicked around and shown so many times in the 50s that it does look this bad. I get that. However, you know, as Richard says, why even put it on Blu-ray in the first place?
And considering some of the things that have been put out, and you know that the only existing prints are beaten to death.
Yeah.
To put something out which is barely watchable.
Yeah.
You know, when the technology is where it is at the moment, it's kind of inexcusable.
It is. And if this film were out, I mean, if it were really great, I mean, if this were a film that it's like, wow, how have, you know, so few people seen this? This is a lost classic. You know, then I would be like, you know what? I don't even care that it looks this bad. I'm just happy for the privilege of seeing it. But that's not what this is. That's not at all what this is. This is a very middling movie, a very standard film, somewhat enjoyable as a relic of its time, somewhat enjoyable for the few flashes of artistic merit that it holds, but overall just not really a film worth picking. Even if it were a pristine print, it would still be hard for me to say, yes, definitely go out and pick this up. So with those problems, I really can't recommend it unless you are somebody that just soaks up black and white movies and crime films like, you know, like syrup on your pancakes. I don't really know what to tell you
for here. The Ida Lupino completist in your life.
If that person really exists. And once again, because it's a Kino, no subtitles. Kino, we're gonna get you on this, man. We're gonna keep complaining at you until one day you finally see the light and start putting subtitles on your Blu-rays, because frankly, I know that I am not hearing impaired, but sometimes with a film like this where if I crank it up too loud, I can hear every piece of static, every crack and split on the film going through the system. You know, I don't want to crank it up that loud. And sometimes it's hard, if it's not recorded just right, it's hard to hear what this guy says versus that guy. So you crank it up and then gunshots ring out and then you gotta turn it. It's just put subtitles.
It's not expensive.
It's really not.
Yeah.
I'll do it for you. Hire me to do it. I've been looking for a new gig anyway. So long, one of us. Oh, wait, I don't have the job yet. So from a film that I saw that Richard didn't to the complete opposite situation, Richard, attack!
Oh, yes.
no, that was the name of the movie.
I was like, ha!
He's like, I haven't prepared anything.
Duck and cover!
Wait, everyone, stand in a line and load your guns and gentlemanly fire and then wait for them to return fire. Oh, no, the rebels!
Anyway. The attack. Israeli Arab film. It's cheerful. I remember when I was talking to the guys who made Rabid and Big Bad Wolves. Two wonderful Israeli horror films. And so glad Big Bad Wolves is getting a full-fledged release next year, because it is phenomenal.
Those guys are amazing.
And they're the nicest guys as well. Just give them a real cane sugar Dr. Pepper and they're just like, yay, we're happy. But one of the things they said to me was that there's no metaphor in Israeli cinema. A thing happens, and then there's a film about it 6 months later. You know, and they said that's why there's been no horror films, because, you know, horror is metaphorical. Mm. This is just like, no, something happens at the Golan Heights, you're going to have 6 films about the Golan Heights 6 months later. This is based on a novel, and I cannot remember the name of the novelist, so I'm a terrible human being. And it's a really clever idea for a story. An Arab doctor living in Israel is receiving an award for being a really great surgeon, and the day afterwards there is a huge explosion and 18 people are killed, and he goes to the hospital and helps treat them, and they say, well, one of the people is your wife. And then they say, yeah, she was the bomber.
What?
And there's a wonderful...
There's an awkward dinner conversation.
Yeah. Well, she... yeah, and there's a wonderful sequence where he goes to identify her body, and it is just a phenomenal piece of performance, because it's really... You know, he very slowly opens the bag up, because he's allowed to, because he's, you know, he is a doctor himself. And he opens the bag up, and it's his wife, and she's, you know, obviously horribly damaged by the explosion. And he closes the bag up and says, yes, this is her. And walks down the corridor and hits the floor. You know, his legs just give out from underneath him. And I went back and watched that scene again, just to see the lead up to him just cracking down and hitting the floor, because he can't process what's happening.
Sure.
And it's a phenomenal piece of very small physical acting with a huge payoff. But basically the narrative is about why somebody becomes a terrorist, and him trying to get his head around the fact that they have this nice house and this nice life in Tel Aviv, and she does this thing, and it goes over into the occupied areas. But one of the things that makes it really interesting is it's not just a Jewish and Muslim question.
Right.
Because his wife is a Coptic Christian.
Hmm.
So it throws, for an American audience and an international audience, it throws this bit of the culture you don't necessarily understand, you know, Coptic Arabs, and how they feel about the Palestinian situation. And it's really well done. It's one thing it does extremely well is that sometimes when you watch films that are set in that region, there's things they presume you understand.
Mm-hmm.
As an international audience. And again, talking to Aaron and Navat about their films, they say, yeah, we tried to steer clear of those things because we can make some joke about something and like it's going to go flat because people internationally don't know it. So you have to make sure that it's accessible. And it steers clear of anything which is kind of insular, or you have to have a deep understanding of the politics of the region to really get your head around. And it becomes... It is about the politics of the region, but it's mostly about this guy trying to understand why his wife would do something that is so antithetical to everything they have personally stood for.
Hmm.
And it's about his response. And, you know, he's dealing with the fact that everybody around him is saying, you know, she's a martyr. This was good. And all his Israeli friends are going, you know, she blew up 17 kids.
Yeah.
And him trying to understand this. And just process it. And at the end, you know, the resolution is, you know, can he? And it doesn't give any easy out. I mean, I was very impressed about this. Didn't know anything going in. I think it handled the, you know, his emotional torment extremely well, because he's angry. He's an Arab who is angry at Arab radicals for what they did to his wife. So it doesn't cut any easy paths. I was really, you haven't seen it yet. I really do recommend it. It's a 105 minutes of your time well worth spent, because it does open up this third aspect that I think a lot of people don't understand about. There is a big Christian Arab population in that area who are caught between what everybody expects.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's kind of got this simple two-side view of the of that area of the world, and there's something else new in there. And that really worked well.
I mean, literally, I mean, talking about battle lines being drawn and being very black and white in terms of, you know, one side over here, one side over here, but you're right, there's not a lot of narrative on the Christian influence or the Christian appearance, existence in that region, you know, in that conflict. And now this sounds really interesting. And by the way, the author's name is Yasmina Kadra, I believe is how that's pronounced. So yeah, Attack, this has been released by the Cohen Media Group. They always put out some really interesting independent film. Definitely something you should check out. The Attack is the name of that one. And moving on from there, we are going to talk about I Declare War.
Oh.
So we start
thematically out, similar.
It's funny. We start It's funny. We start out the show with the biggest release of the week by far, Man of Steel, a huge studio movie. And then from there, we are just talking about releases from smaller and smaller houses. This one comes from Draft House Films, based right here in Austin, Texas. And this was a film that I actually saw at Action Fest 2011 in April. And maybe it was 2012. I don't know. Anyway, the point is, it was a really cool movie. The basic premise is that you have these kids that are playing a war game in their backyard. However, the film takes the visual gimmick, I guess you could say, of projecting the world as the kids would see it. So you're not just seeing kids with sticks going bang, bang, and people falling down. You're seeing a really violent, really explosive war film, because that's how the kids are perceiving it in their minds. That's how much this game means to them, which I think rubbed a few people the wrong way. Like, oh, this movie's terrible. There's child murder. It's like, nah, you're missing the point. The point is that none of this is actually happening except within their imagination. I know you're a big fan of this
film. I love this film. It's half Full Metal Jacket, half Calvin and Hobbes. and the fact that the filmmakers get that to work, and for there to be this consistent tone about it. And you know, it's really wonderful, because it catches kids at this really incredible age. There are all the actors are between about 12 and 14, and there is one girl thrown into the mix, which could have been very badly handled, but is in, you know, she's one of the most fascinating performances, because she's not portrayed as, oh, she's above this and she gets everything. And sometimes, you know, teenage girls are written as too cool
and to be smart in their own movie.
And they're unreal. That makes them unrealistic.
Totally.
And she's not. She's flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And her reasons for being part of this game with a bunch of 12-year-olds are really fascinating and really beautifully played out. And then you have this, you know, the underlying violence. It's like they're playing at violence, but there's some real gripes between some of the kids, and it starts to snowball, because one of them goes, hey, I can do this because we're playing war. And this is making me violent. It's a cover for what I can do. And it also plays brilliantly with where your sympathies lie.
Sure.
Because a couple of the characters are really dickish. Some of them are just like those spazzy 12-year-olds who are just bouncing off the walls with too much sugar. And it's really beautifully put together. For a film which was shot in, you know, over a couple of weekends in a bit of scrubby forest just outside of Vancouver, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I've not seen anything quite like it, because it treats kids with the respect that they deserve by saying, hey, they're not that pleasant. Kids are awful, and we'll be awful to each other, and we'll throw stones at each other's heads, because you know what? They're not fully formed humans yet.
Yeah.
You get this feeling of just this little world that they've created around themselves.
Yeah, I think that's where the respect comes in, is the acknowledgement of the rich detailed world that they can construct out of just picking up sticks and throwing rocks. I mean, you have the most primal of playgrounds, which is just the woods, sticks, and rocks. And from that, because of the imaginative power of a child, which can, as we find out in the film, become completely warped, but that power, like that ability to create so much out of so little is really admirable, and I think where a lot of the movie's heart lies. Even as the characters start to get more and more aggressive toward each other, and one of them is sort of a... it looks like he's joined the future sociopaths of America, even though it's Canadian. It just seems
of
like...
North America.
Of North America. Mm. It seems like it maintains a lot of what's lovable about it, because throughout the movie you can't help but remember that what you're seeing is the product of a child's imagination. And that there is not such an innocence in that as you would necessarily think. It can be used to create a world that is really horrific and violent. But at the end of the day, when the game's over, it's still like, okay, see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like that is one of the things that I love about these characters, is that no matter how deep into this vengeful, dark and miserable story they get, by the end of it, they're just like, okay, well, that's the game, and I'll see you tomorrow. Like, they recognize, that's almost like an indoctrination, or not indoctrination, an admonishment of military culture, is that the kids can still walk away from this. As dark as they get, they can still recognize at the end, well, it's just a game. You know?
And there is one character who, because it, you know, it's very strictly laid out, you know, mm-hmm. a stick with a can tied to it becomes an AK-47. There's a wonderful bit where one of the characters finds this, you know, thin log and goes, oh, this is wonderful, I can make this a bazooka. This is, you know, so the whatever they're carrying has a sense of logic to it. But there's one kid who goes, no, my gun's rubbish, I could just make your head explode just by looking at you. And the rest of them just look at him and go, what are you doing? You can't do that. It doesn't work. And he's like, aww, rats. <It's> like,
that's not how the military complex works. You can't just make mental weapons.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like there's very little fantasy in this fantasy world. It's not about magical powers. It's not about superheroes. It's about the sheer primal experience of one man versus another man in combat. And it's strange to see a child grasp that concept so so fully, and yet that's exactly what's going on in I Declare War.
And this is a film that could have fallen flat in so many ways. It would be so easy for this to not work.
Yeah.
But it just strikes this incredible note.
Yeah.
That I've rarely seen a film with that kind of purity vision where there's no moment where you go, no, they've kind of fallen off the log a little bit. It's absolutely spot on.
Definitely. And certainly a great film for Drafthouse Films to have picked
up. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it seems to fit right in with their... I mean, if you've ever met Tim League, one of his favorite things to do with visiting guests at Fantastic Fest is to take them out into a field and let them shoot automatic weapons. This is a man who never grew out of that stage of his life, who never stopped playing war games. He just does it now in a much more secluded and protected fashion. But, I mean, it just fits so in line with what's going on at the Draft House, and I was really happy to see them pick it up. And so should you. That's I Declare War, now on Blu-ray from Draft House Films.
And I haven't had a chance to check, but I may be in one of the extras.
Really?
Yeah. When they gave it its cinematic release, they did one of the famous Draft House Rolling Road shows out at the stunt farm.
Is this the paintball game?
Yeah.
I was there.
We may be in it then. We need to check. Because we may both be in it.
That's, wow.
We may get caught by, you know, the pro cam, the GoPro that they stuck to Tim League's chest. So there's a minor chance we may be in an extra. If so, we're really sorry, listeners. Yeah,
sorry about that. But I will share this story about that Capture the Flag game. I had never played paintball before. Wasn't really sure what I was doing. Still wasn't in the best of shape, but my wife, on the other hand, fully embraced what was going on. And in the first match, you know, we had these clearly defined, you know, battle lines, and there was all this like fog machine, and we were playing a group of children.
Yeah.
But these were kids that had been playing paintball for a long time, so they were all much better than us. My wife just goes barreling into their territory, right across enemy lines, grabs the flag and just runs all the way back with it. They had no idea what to do. They were like, she just came and took it. We didn't expect anybody to just come over and we thought there would be like a gentle progression maybe through the lines that we would have to fight off wave after wave. Nope, just one girl just hauling ass into your camp, taking your flag and running all the way back. It was the most incredible thing I'd ever seen.
And we beat them in, was it two games or three games?
I believe it was two. Second game went a lot longer.
We were so happy that a bunch of, you know, out of shape 30 and 40 year old film nerds, you know, yep, pummeled a bunch of 10-year-olds. Yeah, it's like victory is ours.
We took as much enjoyment out of that as possible, and then about 10 times more of that. So
yeah, but then, you know, they could actually get off the battlefield under their own steam.
That's true. We were just
need a minute.
I tried to record like a war journal during that game, and I had this little tape recorder that I actually taped to the inside of the paintball mask. I was like, oh, then I won't even have to hold it. But all you hear throughout the recording is, I ran 15 feet. So, yeah, that's something that will probably never be released.
There is something really rewarding, though, about shooting a paintball gun and hearing a small child go, ow!
That's true. I was
so wrong.
I kind of, for the second game, I was a little tired, so I kind of took up flag guarding duty. And I heard this rustling. So I was like at the very back of our camp, but I heard this rustling sound in the tree line behind me. So I kind of quietly snuck through, and I saw like just this little glint of clothing in one of the bushes. And I just opened fire and just like splattered paint all over that bush. And then all of a sudden I hear, I'm out! I'm out! I'm sorry! And it was one of these little bastards that tried to sneak behind our camp to steal the flag and didn't count on me just like not caring about ammo and just like plastering this bush with paint. It was like, and anyone behind it was certainly going to get hit. That was a lot of fun.
You'll make such a great parent.
Right? I am totally ready for kids. Anywho, moving on from there, we're going to move on to the latest release from Blue Underground. Now, if you're not familiar with Blue Underground, it was actually a company started by director William Lustig, who made Maniac and Vigilante and Maniac Cop. He likes the word maniac, apparently. A really cool 80s... exploitation, I guess, filmmaker. Really good stuff, but he had a fascination with Italian horror films and got tired of the fact that he could never get a good copy in the States, so he bought the rights to all of these various... He's put out a lot of Argento and a lot of Fulci, and he just bought up the rights and started releasing it, and the early stuff from Blue Underground was just incredible.
Oh, yeah.
They did a great... And now, I feel like anymore, they're sort of running to the end of their lot of films they've bought the rights to, and now they're releasing some things that it's just like... Okay. One such example is the film Snuff from 1976, which was directed by Roberta and Michael Finlay, who...
Made up names!
Yeah, totally, totally made up names. But these two were sort of known at the time as being the grimiest and sleaziest of the 42nd Street exploitation directors, and they just happened to be husband and wife. And so they made this film...
happened? Nobody else would have them. Be honest.
Yeah, that's true. They made this film called Snuff, and of course Snuff was sort of an urban legend at the time. It was starting to get a lot of traction of this idea that there were movies made where women are sort of used as a sexual object and then murdered on camera. And it was just starting to gain traction as a myth, so they decided, both with that going on and in the wake of the Manson murders, they're like, well, let's make this movie where someone actually dies, and except that they won't, but we will profligate or perpetuate this rumor that indeed someone has been killed. And the way we're going to do that is at the end of this very boring crime story about a rampaging Satan sex motorcycle gang. I know. How do you make that boring? How do the words I just said result in something boring? Anyway,
only they and Zack Snyder could do it.
But at the end of the film, it literally pulls this meta thing where the last scene in the film, we then pull back and see the filming of that scene, and supposedly the girl that was murdered at the end of the movie has actually now been murdered, and then we watch as the director murders another woman right in front of us, and somehow pulls her heart out of her belly button, so you know it's real.
Accurate.
Totally anatomically correct. So what this film is it's a remnant of a period in which the only way to get any notice for your film whatsoever was to be as despicable as possible, to be like the absolute dingiest and underhanded and slimy motion picture imaginable. And then the Finlays were, this is what they did. This was their forte.
It's the ending scene is just the greatest cinematic desperation play ever.
Yeah. Because the rest of the movie really is just like, oh, okay, all
right. It's car crash bad.
Yeah, and I mean, you're watching it and you're like...
Not even a good car crash. I mean, literally, it's like a fender bender of like...
It's a car crash
stabbing.
Where you can't determine who's driving what car and what car hit which other one. And it's there are literally scenes where people will show up screaming and arguing at each other. And I'm like, I'm sorry, hi. Have you been introduced in the film yet? No? Okay, well, carry on. I guess this is just what we're doing now. And I don't know. I found it a chore to get to the end. And then when I did get to the end, I was marveling at this, as you said, very desperate attempt to shock audiences by quote unquote really killing this girl live in front of, you know, in front of the camera. But again, when you're pulling her still beating heart out of her stomach that you've cut open, how in the blue fuck did you expect anybody to believe that that was real? And yet that was exactly what they tried to do. In fact, I read that one of the things that they did to further the lore of this being a real snuff film is they hired people to protest their own movie. And so...
I've seen it. You don't need to hire people to protest it. You could just get film fans to stand outside and go, down with this kind of thing. This is awful.
So right outside of these grindhouse theaters on 42nd Street in New York are these people pretending to protest, which apparently I heard did draw an actual protest from a group called Women Against Pornography. The movie's kind of pornographic. I don't know. It relies a lot on sex, but then it's all told in cutaway, so I don't know that I would really call it pornographic. It's very suggestive, maybe is a better word. But then the violence of the movie is like Herschel Gordon Lewis splatter film type gore. At no point do you ever consider the idea that any of this could be real, and yet this film exists as essentially an attempt to cash in on the once hyper, the fear maybe, or the hyper awareness that there could potentially be real snuff out there.
Yeah.
And of course, the sort of residing in the wake of the Manson family murders and cashing in on that as well. And I don't know. I don't have a lot of nice things to say about the
Finlays. Well, there's not anything nice to say about this film. There is somebody could do something really interesting, mm-hmm. and I don't know that anybody ever has, about that fear that actresses have when they make make horror films, and I think it is primarily, you know, actresses, because they tend to so often to end up, you know, the first major body that you see, and you know I'm trying to remember her name now, from the Blair Witch Project,
Heather Donahue.
Yes, and she said in quite a few interviews when she was making it, she'd be like, so I'm out in the woods making this horror film mm-hmm. with these four guys who I've never met before, and we're making a film, no, really, honestly. And she said, yeah, there's a few moments where I'm like, no.
They're just going to kill
me. There's no way this ends well for me. And then, of course, she was the only one who had a real acting career afterwards, which, like, whatever happened to the rest of them? So there is that kind of... There's such an interesting idea in that final scene, and they botch it because they're the worst of what you get from exploitation. There's no
merit in what they do. Yeah. And in fact, the film starts with a ripped-off sound-alike version of Steppenwolf's Born to be Wild, while a girl and a guy are riding a motorcycle, just because it's like, oh, yeah, Easy Rider made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, that's the only reason that they even ride motorcycles in the film, is to, like, oh, yeah, maybe Easy Rider money. Let's get some of that, too.
God, wouldn't it be brilliant if somebody did kind of a movie about snuff in the same way that the stuntman handled how people doing stunts go, well, hang on, I'm really actually in danger, and what if the director is like is one step ahead of me and is really putting me in peril and I don't know what's happening? There's such a great idea in there somewhere for a film which is actually about snuff, and this isn't. This is a terrible, terrible, you know, Manson exploitation piece of shit, which happens to have this awful scene lumped onto the end. And I don't even know, I'm sure I've read on a few places that actually they made the film and then went, well, no one's going to care. What can we do? And went back and reshot that afterwards.
Because the film was originally called Slaughter.
Yeah.
And then it was, after it was completed, it was called Snuff. So I believe that entirely. Now, Michael Finlay, interestingly enough, the cover for this film, not just the Blu-ray, but the film itself, the poster for the film, showed a woman who was kind of cut into multiple pieces. Michael Finley was killed in a helicopter crash where a helicopter, like, basically was landing on the roof of a building in New York and then, like, tilted sideways and he was killed by the rotors.
Ew.
I'm not reveling in that at all. It's just sort of a bizarrely ironic twist on this whole thing is that that's how he ended up meeting his very grisly end.
That's a little bit Twilight Zone.
Like Vic Morrow. Unfortunate. But good note to end on. But as far as this Blu-ray, the one very strange... First of all, to Blue Underground's credit, I don't know why they took the time to do this, but the movie does look good. For a film that was probably shot in with as little care for how it looked as possible and was thrown into these basement theaters without any care as to whether it looked good at all, they've done a good... You know, this is the difference between Blue Underground and Kino. It's like, yeah, here is a movie that even less people care about than The Hitchhiker, but it looks leaps and bounds better. I'm just going to point that out. And oddly enough, Nicholas Winding Refn, the director of Drive and Only God Forgives, not only does an intro for the film, but it is this interview where he talks about sort of his admiration for it. And yet, even as he's espousing the reasons why he's there to talk about the film, he says, it's a movie that's better to not see. Like, it's better to not have seen it than to have seen it. So even the guy, even the celebrity endorsement they bring in is still like, this movie sucks. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And so that was really bizarre to me. But again, if I don't know who I could possibly recommend this to. I feel like if you are among the group that are really interested in this film, that maybe I should alert the authorities. I don't know.
People who want to make sure that William Lustig has a good and healthy retirement.
There you go. There you go. To support Bill Lustig, definitely pick up.
Just send him $5. Which seems easier.
What I do find weird about this release is that it's red. Where you buy a Blu-ray and it has the blue top and the blue bottom to the box. This is red.
Well,
and funny enough, this has kind of been this will be a show for that because this is red. The Attack from Cohen Media is clear, and when we get to the last title of the show in just a few moments. That Blu-ray is actually a black ray. I don't know how else you would describe it. It is completely black. It's really cool looking. Anywho, before we get to that, let's talk about the latest release of Nosferatu.
Oh, yes.
Now, this movie has been released, I think, now, this is a conservative guess, 237 times across multiple formats.
Last week. Yeah.
It is one of the very first horror films, arguably the first horror film, but it's not the first horror film. But anyway, one of the very first.
I think
first
it's the first one that survives.
That's, yes. There we go. There you go. We're talking about a progenitor horror film. The first, if nothing else, the first incarnation of Dracula. On screen.
Allegedly. The lawyers can't prove it.
Allegedly. And of course, this stars Max Schreck as Count Orloff, who is one of the creepiest figures in film history. Just like, very pointy face and this pointy nose and these like Vulcan ears, completely bald head, long spindly fingers with sharp claw-like nails. Just very eerie guy. And of course, if you've seen the movie Shadow of a Vampire, it speculates that the actor... Max Schreck was himself a very weird guy. But anyway, so Richard, tell us a little bit about what stands out about this particular release of Nosferatu.
Well, for everything that Kino Lorber dropped the ball on with The Hitchhiker, this is a beautiful transfer.
Excellent.
I mean, it really looks... there's two different versions here. There's because it's the 2006 restoration, which I think has been released previously anyway, but it just looks really great. Mm-hmm. There's the version with the German interstitial cards, which I'm sure, somebody out there that's real completist stuff. So most people are going to watch it with the English language interstitials. The soundtrack is amazing. The score is... And I've seen so many bad scores to this film, which are just kind of cheesy. You don't really bring the sense of menace up. This is a full orchestral score. Really fabulous. Just builds the tension, even in some of the places that can be a bit cheesy and campy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the character of Hutter, who is basically the Jonathan Harker character, I can't remember the name of the actor, but he is so hammy. He's actually more frightening in places than the Count. He's just... But it's a phenomenal version of the film. And I've had two or three different copies over the years, and it just looks beautiful. The other really great thing about this disc is there is an hour-long documentary about F.W. Murnau and the making and the origin of Nosferatu. Not the various legal problems they had, because this was definitely not Dracula. Well, it was, and that was part of their problem, that they then had to burn every single print. And they were sued by Bram Stoker's wife, because this was an unlicensed version of Dracula. Mm-hmm. They were supposed to, part of the legal settlement, they had to destroy every copy. And it was just sheer luck that Nosferatu survives. And in fact, the first seven films F.W. Murnau made are completely gone. There's fragments of a couple of them, but that's it.
Wow.
And they include some of those fragments on this disc in this great one-hour documentary, which is fascinating because, first of all, it gives you a real insight into Murnau and where he came from as a filmmaker and how his influences serving in the trenches during World War One really influenced him and really influenced German culture after the war. Everybody remembers, obviously, the Nazis, a little bit of an issue. But he was part of Weimar Germany, which was, people trying to come to terms with the fact that they had inflicted this war on the rest of Europe. And Nosferatu comes from this confluence of this pacifist streak and this rejection of what Germany had been and this real feeling that the aristocracy had blighted Europe, and there's no accident that it is Count Orlok. There's a rejection there of the aristocracy that had run Germany and run it into ruin. But what was really fascinating, I didn't know, was that the film company they set up to make Nosferatu was supposed to be the world's first occult specialist production company. And they were just going to do occult movies. And things like the letters that Orlok sends are actually taken from occult texts. Huh. And the whole thing is riddled with symbolism. And the look of Orlok himself is taken from an illustration from a pivotal late 19th century German occult text. And it's a depiction of a ghoul. Mm-hmm. And they said, we're going to do this. We're going to bring this in. It really brings in, because everybody talks about Murnau and his importance, and he was an incredible filmmaker. And this really, you just sit back and watch how, considering he's basically, making this with a wooden box with a piece of glass in front of it. I mean, this is very, very primitive film technology. Yeah. And you look at how he composes the shot, how he uses shadow. Mm-hmm. When he had, he's got to wait 3 days for rushes to come back. He doesn't know what stuff's going to look like.
Yeah.
He probably can't go back and reshoot. The whole thing looks incredible, and you really get to appreciate how much he influenced cinema. But Grau, who was his producer and was the real hardcore occultist, his designs and his ideas of what this needs to look like, and him saying, here's this book we need to bring in, and the whole idea, the famous shots of Max Schreck's hand reaching out, but you don't see his hand, you only see the shadow, mm-hmm. that's a pivotal part of early 20th century German occult theory. And they were going to do more films like this. And then they got sued by Bram Stoker's wife and they went out of business. So we never got to see all these projects.
Man.
But that that doc alone is worth the price of the disc. Because, just examining all these remaining artifacts from these films that were never made. And there's some really kind of weird and goofy stuff in there. Like there's actually an advert for 30 to 50 rats. And it was from the local newspaper when they were making it. They needed rats. And, at that point, there wasn't Rats R Us. You couldn't go to...
There wasn't somebody making their living being a rat wrangler for films.
So they just said, well, we need some rats. If you bring us rats, we will pay you for it. And they just put this advert in the local paper saying, bring us 30 to 50 rats. And we for our film. And it's like, the obsession that the documentarian had to go through to just find this stuff is astonishing, but it pays off. And then, it's Nosferatu. If you don't own a copy of Nosferatu,
this is the
which
one
is though. Which is weird and wrong.
Yeah.
You should. if you've got the 2006-7 restoration, this is the same one. You may have the documentary already. There's not really any reason to upgrade. But if you don't have it, this is something you really need in your collection because it's phenomenal. It's still landmark.
Okay, so is there just the one score option? Because I know this is a film that, like Metropolis, two things. one, it seems like they keep doing like, oh, we found this extra scene, or we've, you know, like this restoration is different from that restoration. And the other thing is that there's different scores from various artists that will sometimes come in and do, you know, like this is the, like, for example, with the case of Metropolis, like this is the Giorgio Moroder score. I'm just curious with this particular film.
I think
film.
It's the original score that was, because it was done with a live orchestra.
Right.
So I think they've just restored that. Mm-hmm. And I think they've just done a really good restoration, a recreation of what it was like, and really sympathetic to the film. Some of them have just kind of, like I said, they've gone a bit camp.
Sure.
And this hasn't. This has really caught an air of menace. I think it's possibly a new arrangement to the score, but it's really fabulous.
Excellent. Well, definitely, as Richard said, if you don't already own Nosferatu,
you're weird.
You're weird, and you should correct that by picking up this Kino release. What is this? Is it an anniversary edition? How do they label it?
I can't remember. I think it's just, oh, it's, you know, it's about time.
Nosferatu, the about time release.
It might be the 90th anniversary, I want to say.
Jesus. Wow.
Because I think it was 1922.
Film is starting to be that grand old man.
Yeah, I think it's just generally, it's like, probably should. You know, probably should to just make up for it. Yeah, somewhere, and like I said, the restoration is probably making, you know, the Idol Pino fan club livid about Hitchhikers. We still love you at some levels, Kino Lorber, but you know, if you can do it for this, you can do it for anything.
Agreed. Well, that brings us to the last title of the show, which is also going to be our giveaway!
Giveaway!
And it is the latest web series from Rooster Teeth, the creators of Red vs. Blue, entitled Ruby. Now, Ruby is a...
Ruby.
Ruby. W-R-B-Y. Ruby. Is a story that is told in anime style, but it's computer-generated, which is something I have never seen before, personally. I don't know if maybe I'm just not as versed in anime as...
I have, but this is very... It took me a while to get used to the style of it because they make some very definite stylistic decisions because they don't have,
a huge studio
or ridiculous processor time. So they make some decisions.
So they make some decisions.
Well, I mean, it's like if you're a background character, they don't render you. They don't do anything. You are a black and white shape.
That's true.
Well, in fact, just a black shape walking across. So you can tell if a character is actually important because you can actually see them.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, this is the story. It takes place in a world where these characters, these monsters known as Grimms, are sort of wreaking havoc. And it's up to a group of these women, essentially, who have powers and have specialized weapons. And they're given their powers by this, and I mean, we're getting into the Golden Compass territory a little bit here, but this magic called Dust, which gives them, you know, these abilities and helps these incredible weapons that they have. And they're trained as huntresses to go and destroy the Grimms. Now, this takes place at a school where this group of huntresses in training have banded together. And Ruby is basically their various colors strung together. So you have your red, white, black, and yellow. Ruby is just sort of the story about how these four girls with these four individual powers and weapons are fighting these grim monsters. I think for anyone who is a big fan of sort of two things. One is I think this will please anime fans because it's not like every other anime you've ever seen. It's got a lot of the keynotes that you expect to see in anime stories, but it doesn't look exactly the same as every other anime or even every other American version of anime.
Yeah.
Because that's even its own thing. I don't know if there's a name for Americame. But this is a really interesting, it's a fun story. It's a compelling story. There are some moments where, despite the limitations of the medium that they're using, they do pull off some really beautiful cinematic type shots. And I guarantee you, if nothing else, there will be so many girls cosplaying as these characters.
Oh, God, yeah.
At the next Comic-Con. I mean, Rooster Teeth is already a cult phenomenon as it is. So with this being about a group of badass girls with really badass powers and badass weapons, you can bet your bottom dollar and your top dollar that you will spend on the costumes that there will be girls dressed as the various Ruby characters at next Comic-Con. And we have not one but two copies to give away. And as I said, this is a really cool release because, the Blu-ray that would normally be the insert around a blue box is actually around a black box, so it's entirely black. And it's just, it's a really good, there's a behind the scenes video. There's a thing of, fan art. There's a whole tribute to their fan art.
Which was amazing because the fan art that they got, and this shows the power of Rooster Teeth.
Yeah.
They were getting fan art from the trailers.
That's true.
And, and they're going, yeah, we were just like, we just put these trailers out and we thought, you know, that'd be fun. And one of the things that they talk about in that extra, which is the weirdest kind of extra, but really cool at the same time, is when they did the trailers, they were very cinematic and it was these big action sequences. And for each of the characters, people did the posters and they were, you know, big and cinematic and mm-hmm. you know, scythes and big guns and, you know, and as they've gone on and people got to know the characters, and it does have a goofy sense of humor. I mean, there's also, it's kind of...
There's a villain in the first episode that is right out of Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
And even in the way he moves, it's like, okay, that's interesting.
And there's a lot of Harry Potter in here.
Let's
be honest. Sure. There's a big chunk of Harry Potter in here.
Of course there
is. And I hate Harry Potter. I'm not afraid to say that.
How are you allowed to hate Harry Potter?
Because I can. It's the accent.
You don't
tea.
You don't like Harry Potter. You're going to tell me you don't like cricket next.
No, I love cricket.
Okay, good.
That's because I love any sport which actually has a break for a meal in the middle of it, which is true. You break for tea. Sometime between 4 and 6, you break for tea.
Well, that's good. We call that the seventh inning stretch in baseball, but it's not for a meal. It's for a beer.
And... Yeah, you go and get a terrible hot dog and you know, a Bud
Horror. That's
where
you're wrong.
Whereas this is like, there's cake and cups of tea and tiny sandwiches. It's,
you know,
awesome.
I will not apologize for calling your people dainty.
But... Again, sharp edge of my boot. But you know, even I, as somebody with a pathological hatred of all things Harry Potter, was like, you know what? I'm okay with this. Mm-hmm. It also has its odd, very serious debt to the original, definitive, and still, to my mind, best piece of American anime-influenced TV. Which is Avatar: The Last Airbender, mm-hmm. Which I, you know, I still think is, you know, one of the best things that has been on American TV in the past 10 years. You know, screw you and your Breaking Bad. I'm going to stick with season 3 of Avatar: The Last Airbender.
There are a lot of people listening to this who will agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah. When Iroh, the whole Iroh story, God, that's the only piece of TV that made me truly cry. Anyway, complete side point. This actually, it sets up season 2 really well. I have a good feeling for where the world is going. Mm-hmm. The characters are fun. And they get goofy and goofy, which ties back to the fan art. They said, you know, the first stuff was all like big and epic and you know, people trying to be Drew Struzan. And by the end, it's all like, chibi, and we're hitting each other with rubber mallets. And it's actually, I like this way more than I was expecting to. Because I got to say, Red versus Blue... God, you know, I stopped caring a long time ago because there's so much of it. Mm-hmm. This, I'm like, I actually want to see where the world goes. And that, I think that is, you know, with any web series, if you get to the end of the first season and you're like, I want to know where this is going, they're doing something right.
Absolutely. So we have 2 copies of this Blu-ray to give away. And as you know, we do sort of creative writing prompts in order to win our giveaways. And I do want to remind you that you're going to need to be following one of us on Twitter so that we can contact you and let you know that you've won. That is at one of us net. So please do be following, because the way we contact you and let you know that you've won is via direct message on Twitter. So please do follow one of us net on Twitter. But then in the comment section under this post, what I want you to do for this week is I want you to tell me about your ideal 2-part weapon. Now, Ruby Rose, the main character in this, has an incredible, just like massive techno scythe that is also a shotgun. It's a really bizarre weapon. It's very unwieldy, but it is really, really cool. And I want you guys to create your sort of weapon that is this and also this. It can be funny. It can be serious. It could be just plain badass, whatever you want it to be. But go ahead in the comment section under this post and let us know what your 2-part weapon would be. And we will pick 2 of our favorites from the comment section. We will contact those people via Twitter and let them know that, hey, you have won, and we will send that right out to you. And guys, thanks again for listening to the show and for following us on Twitter. You can also like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/digitalnoise.oneofusnet. No, digitalnoise.oneofus. I always get the fucking Facebook wrong for Digital Noise. The Facebook for One of Us proper is facebook.com/oneofusnet. You can also follow the show individually on Twitter @DigiNoiseCast. You can follow me @BryGuySalisbury, or you can follow Richard at...
At Yorkshire TX.
Yorkshire TX. That's so prim and proper, I can't even... There's a shire in it.
Rolls off the tongue.
There's a shire in the name. What are you going to do? Anywho, that brings us to the end of another episode here of Digital Noise. Again, thanks for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you'll take part in this particular giveaway. Hope you will pick us up on iTunes, become a subscriber, all that good stuff. And yeah, I guess until next week, stay Ruby.